Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
There's this theory that these scientists came up with after studying tribes in India and Africa, South America. The smaller tribes didn't have any government, didn't need any. They could sit down and talk out their problems, decide where to plant crops, to hunt. It was just a big family, really. But when the number of people got up around 500, if there wasn't any government, the strongest people would take advantage of the weakest. Every time, without fail, they would enslave, rape, steal, enrich their lives at the expense of other people's lives. Government's man's way of trying to control our behavior, but it can't be controlled. That's what we are. Sooner or later, the kind of people that would enrich themselves at your expense, we use the government to do it. And mark my words, one day they'll create laws to control what we say, how we think. They'll outlaw our right to disagree if we let them.
Preach it, Han Solo. From the show, 1923. So true. And as Gordon White said, tyranny requires centralization to thrive, to spread its archonic fungi infection. Disagreeing is now an act of war in this culture, if you hadn't noticed. Above all, no redeeming, reforming, or even coexisting with our government exists. Yaldabaoth has made it entirely in his ghoulish image. Don't you see this? It's too late. The Empire's supreme, and until you accept this, get over that safety chimera, and realize part of you is a program foot soldier in the war against Sophia, things will only get frog in the boiling water worse.
All fellow members of the Roman Senate, hear me. Shall we continue to build palace after palace for the rich? Or shall we aspire to a more noble purpose and build decent housing for the poor? How does the Senate vote?
Fuck the poor!
Good.
It's interesting, too, that Western-themed shows are very popular these days, like 1923, 1883, Yellowstone, and Tulsa King. There are no coincidences. Beyond any Taylor-Sheridan conspiracies, to me it means it's part of that Gnostic awakening. After all, the Wild West, as Jason Horsley once wrote, is the best representation of the desert of the real. And quoting Gordon again, Gnosticism is a desert song.
When I looked out over this land, I only saw the freedom it promised. I knew nothing of the horror that hides in freedom's shadow.
We are talking about a land of mirages and false gold. In the frontier land, it seems the animals, the terrain, and even the climate is eternally trying to kill us. Not just kill us, but drive us insane. As the saying goes, whom the gods would destroy, they first make mad. This land fashioned native empires of deranged scalping and human sacrifice, turned colonists and pioneers into unhinged prophets of capitalism. What's more, this is a harsh land where the trickster coyote rules, along with the Dust Bowl demons and the curse of ancient giants.
You know what you think about it? Same God made you and me also made a rattlesnake. That just don't make no sense.
On the other hand, abundant sparks of magic and liberation exist behind dusty illusions. As does the call of lost goddesses and enchanted portals in the shape of sunsets.
There is no heaven to go to, because we're in it already. We're in hell, too. They coexist right beside each other. And God is the land.
The trickster and the lost goddess will lead the way to your apotheosis, but can also lead you astray into the nihilistic madness of solely accepting that most of what you are is just a manufactured meat sack dinner for the various archons. And not accepting the great reminder there is no safety in freedom. There was never any safety to begin with, nor independence. Just those liberating portals and the call of the coyote and the lost goddess. As Jorge Luis Borges wrote in his story about the Gnostic Basilides, we are a careless or criminal blunder, the fruit of engagement of the flawed deity in crude material, the world presented as a primarily pernicious creation, an oblique and perverted reflection of the divine celestial decrees. Creation as a play of chance, like on a plane at the tour of magnificent sunset. The skies are solemn and burning and the earth is wretched.
Freedom. To most, it is an idea. An abstract thought that pertains to control. That's not freedom. That's independence. Freedom is riding wild over untamed land with no notion any moment exists beyond the one you are living.
In that Gnostic awakening, we now see the hologram falter and know that in 2023, it's still the desert of the real, that the Wild West is all around. It's like that greatest of modern gospels, Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy. A terra damnata that we must tame with our imagination, meaning, and innate magic. Or we'll go bananas before the gods destroy us.
Sophia, ask yourself, what god made a world like this one?
A real shitty god. The same one that created this world.
So welcome to the desert of the real. Welcome to Aeon Byte. Welcome, you pioneers of the wondrous, of the forgotten, of Dreamtime itself. My name is Miguel Connor, your Pompidus of Gnosis, and I am once again honored to have your wisdom and power keeping me company in this terra damnata.
If we have souls, they are made of the love we share. Undimmed by time, unbound by death.
We deal with the Wild West in this eternal now and show how it extends beyond America, beyond the material world. As above, so below, Hermes Trismegistus said, speaking through Apollonius of Tyana. The mirages and false gold extend into the heavens, and the demiurge reflects his government in the digital domains of today. Moreover, as you'll see, the desert song of the Gnostics has existed in the sands of ancient Egypt and Israel, in the twisted desires of medieval treasure hunters and corrupt alchemists. And more, so much more, Yaldibaldi. But we don't care anymore about safety, just freedom. Freedom in running with those searching for the truth and avoiding those who have found it.
As Dr. King said, we know through painful experience that freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed.
For all of this, we are joined by Tom Montauk, who will discuss his excellent Red Pill suppository book, Gnosis, Alchemy, Grail, Ark, and the Demiurge. Gird your loins and plug your vag canals for one of the most enlightening yet startling interviews on Aeon Byte. Tom is a cowboy of pure gnosis.
What truth is that? That there isn't one world, but many, and that we live in the wrong one. This will help them find the door.
For more perspective on this Terra Damnata, this cosmic Wild West and frontier land, let us end with a passage from past guest Alexander Mostrovoy, from his also excellent book, Gnosticism Through the Prism of the Third Millennium.
Will our cults explode?
Gnosticism endued its followers not with faith, but with knowledge. Gnosis liberated the human being from the darkness of the material world. Liberation, according to Valentinus, is knowledge. What liberates is the knowledge of who we were, what we became, where we were, whereinto we have been thrown, whereto we speed, wherefrom we are redeemed, what birth is, and what rebirth is.
Who am I? That's the real question, isn't it? Who am I? Who are you? What other questions are there? What other questions are there, really? If you want to understand the universe, embrace the universe, the door to the universe is you.
The human being is cast into this world, dusky, onerous, cold, crude, and cruel, at times maddeningly perverse. Weak and defenseless, he is just a life bridge in the endless chain of generations. Against his own will, he lives at times all his life, as if in raving delirium, hopelessness and feverish quest for mirages. His existence is pointless and death is agonizing. His mind is haunted by obsession, loneliness and sorrow, and his flesh by sickness, miseries and woes. He is unaware of what is happening to him. Our existence is like a scary dream, and a bat, the symbol of blindness, darkness and nightmares, is the embodiment of it.
Ernest Hemingway once wrote, "The world is a fine place and worth fighting for." I agree with the second part.
But the world of dust is finite and, generally, incidental, like man himself, which means it is inconsequential and secondary. And only spirit's particle, encumbered in a man, is primary, and it is subject to pleroma.
Whoa.
Gnostics did not comfort with the presence of an omnipresent, all-seeing, merciful, and caring supreme being, but claimed that the Creator was absolutely indifferent to the suffering of the creatures made by him. His lips are sealed, and his glance is cold and blind like the world he created. And yet the human being is above his tiny cage of flesh, and above the cosmic Creator, as he carries in himself the understanding of a different, true and perfect world.
Our God has no rules, only ceremonies to know him better, but no rules.
Valentinus maintained that through knowledge, then, is save the inner spiritual man, so that to us suffices the knowledge of universal being. This is the true salvation. Gnosis makes an individual self-sufficient, allowing to exist where life is empty, pointless, and finite.
There's an old Zen koan. It goes like this. Everyone has two lives, and the second life begins the moment you realize that all along, you only had one.
As the Gospel of Truth states, if a person has the Gnosis, he is a being from on high. If he is called, he hears, replies, and turns towards him who calls him, in order to reascend to him. Joy to the man who has rediscovered himself and awakened. This particular vision, free from myths and exaltation of separate teachings, allows to speak about the uniqueness of the Gnostic ideal, irrespective of epoch, culture, and circumstances.
Looking back, there were two journeys. One was filled with danger and death and despair. The other, adventure and wonder. I was on the latter, and I loved it.
Wait, grab that shoulder!
I didn't know enough to know they would collide. I didn't know enough to know how cruel and uncaring this world can be. The world doesn't care if you die. They won't listen to your screams. If you bleed on the ground will drink it. It doesn't care that you're cut. I told myself, when I meet God, it will be the first thing I ask him. Why make a world of such wonder and fill it with monsters? Why make flowers and then snakes to hide beneath them? What purpose does the tornado serve? Then it hit me. He didn't make it for us.
This is the Aeon Byte interview. And with us, we definitely have the pleasure of being joined by Tom Montauk to discuss a book I really enjoyed. And that is Gnosis, Alchemy, Grail, Ark, and the Demiurge. Tom, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Pleasure is all ours, and it is a pleasure to have the Moondog Vance here. Vance, how are you doing?
Very good. Just putting aside my Archon of the Covenant here. Close that up and lock it, and get ready for a good talk.
There you go. There you go. This is wonderful stuff, and yeah, your book definitely, again, I really enjoyed it, and you hit all the right notes, and you gave us a fascinating and often disturbing journey through time and space and reality and everything else to encounter our mutual friend, Yaldabaoth. But before we get into the book, Tom, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in these high weirdness topics?
Yeah, sure. So I've been a paranormal experiencer all my life. I mean, even as a child, I had so many different ghost encounters and what seemed to be possibly even extraterrestrial type encounters. So from an early age, my father was German. I was born in Germany, and he was an electrical engineer. And so his mind was very science oriented, which allowed him to have many conversations with me about the universe, science. I mean, I even remember being 6 years old and discussing relativity with him and physics, electrical engineering, everything like that. And so I was very curious. I was always taking apart different devices, trying to figure out how they worked. And so when I had these paranormal experiences, I was confronted with this this unsolvable mystery of what the heck is going on with reality. You know, I was trying to figure things out, and here was a mystery that could not be figured out by my kid mind. And so that put into my subconscious this deep drive to try to put everything together, really, really try to figure something out that made sense to me, that had no holes, that was self-consistent, you know, that explained so many different things. And so when I was 12 or 13, I got a library card and I read all the spirituality, metaphysics, physics, you know, all the related books on those topics. And my journey just continued from there. So right around 2002, 2003, that's when I was contacted by someone who was, I think he must have been a Rosicrucian, like a real Rosicrucian, not the card carrying AMORC Rosicrucian, but like the real deal. And the things that we were only in touch for a brief time, but some of the things that he told me, I later on dug into it. And that led me to the book called Hamlet's Mill, which is a fascinating book about ancient Indo-European mythology and how it seems to encode the precession of the equinoxes, the wobbling of the Earth's axis over a 26,000-year cycle. Well, that's what the authors of the book thought it was about. But during my investigations into alchemy, Rosicrucianism, Gnosticism, the alien abduction phenomenon, it all started spiraling out from there. And it made me realize that, wait a minute, this Hamlet's Mill book wasn't just about the precession of the equinoxes, but about something far greater having to do with the corruption of our very timeline, with the use of very powerful extraterrestrial technologies to alter reality at a quantum level. And so I started really looking into this and trying to figure out, like, what is it that all these different ancient myths and even modern phenomena like, you know, ufology and Freudian phenomena that John Keel was into, what do all these point towards? And so that's what ultimately gave birth to this Gnosis book.
Wonderful. Yes. John Keel also definitely influences me big time, informs my Gnostic worldview. I think he was well, obviously onto something. And for the audience, Tom's website, which of course we'll have on the show notes, is great, but it's broad. So many wonderful topics just beyond Gnosticism, alchemy. So you could lose yourself in your website, but let's go to your book. As you write, and I am quoting here, "My aim in writing this book was to explore an authentic Gnostic signal in the most diverse sources using the biggest bucket possible." So that's what you were aiming, right? To get a comprehensive theory, full view of what's going on with, as you say, and I agree, this less than real reality.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And my research into the idea of a fake reality, like a matrix reality, that originally happened back in 2001 when I was in college. I went to college for physics and electrical engineering. And I started having many weird synchronicities back then, things that indicated to me that reality was responsive to consciousness. In the dorm room, it became a joke between me and my roommate. Every single day, I would have so many synchronicities, and he would too, that it just became a normal part of life, right? And so I had to reconcile that with my interest in physics, and everything else. And I was trying to put it all together. So that kind of laid the groundwork. And then later on, when I started getting into ancient mythology and Rosicrucianism, Gnosticism, Hermeticism, quantum physics, Freudian and Jungian psychology, it all started to coalesce. And so here we are.
Here we are. Yes. Science and mysticism should be working together. And your dad was always cool with your strange metaphysics?
Interestingly, he was into parapsychology.
There you go.
Yeah, yeah. And my mom, she was from Singapore, so she grew up in a Asian culture. And over there, you know, the idea of ghosts, ancestors, things like that, it's just common knowledge there. I mean, my grandma in Singapore, she was a shaman, and she could converse with the spirits and heal people. And so she had psychic abilities, and my mom did too. So between that paranormal side and my dad's engineering and a little bit of parapsychology side, that did influence me as a child. So it kind of laid the foundation for that too.
Yeah, it's in the family. And do you get people, obviously your experiences parallel mine and certainly Vance's, do you get people asking you, man, I want a mystic experience. I want to see behind the veil. Do you offer them advice, or do you tell them, well, you're either born with it or not?
I think, you know, there are people out there who haven't had a single paranormal experience that they can count, right? And, you know, I don't blame them, because the fact of the matter is we are here for different reasons. You know, each of us is here for our own reason. And some people need that paranormal learning track and other people don't. But, you know, I guess in that sense, it's commendable when someone who doesn't have the experience is interested in it, because then they're not even being shaped by their environment. You know, they're doing it purely out of their own free will and interest. And I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I agree with you. I get sometimes, and I was that way, people want a mystic experience, but at the core, they want it because they're afraid of death. They want to know that there's something out there, like Woody Allen and Hannah and her sisters. And I think that's not the right way to go. You have to first be a deal with your fear of death, which influences all your fears, and that opens channels of communication to a wonderful world out there. What do you think of that?
Yes, yes. And I think the easiest and the most common experience anyone can have is a synchronicity, because that doesn't require being out of body. It doesn't require, you know, seeing ghosts or demons or aliens or anything scary. It's just, you know, when these meaningful coincidences pile up over time, at some point you have to realize, well, wait a minute, this can't just be selection bias or confirmation bias. You know, this can't be that. It has to be something. And then when you really start thinking about, well, okay, well, what are the implications of this? Then it just blows up. And, you know, you really go down the rabbit hole after that point.
Yeah, agreed. As I said, synchronicity is just the divine talking to you. And as I tell people, well, watch out, because you might get what you want, but a mystic experience or God talking to you can pretty much turn your life upside down, right? Everything you knew will be destroyed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, people need personal experience to go off of, and which makes sense, because if you don't go off of personal experience, then all you have left is logic and faith in authority. And faith and authority, as you know, is very dangerous. It's very dangerous because no one in authority is perfect, and typically they have agendas, right? So you put too much faith into that, and you're going to be misled.
Agreed. Well, let's talk about the book itself. Let's start with some broader themes and some of these characters. What is the Matrix control system, Tom?
Okay, so the way that I define the Matrix control system is that it is the invisible system of control that aims to keep us spiritually asleep. So it's, you know, we call it the Matrix control system, and the language for that, as you know, was provided for by the Matrix movies. So that was back in 98, 99. Actually, there was a spate of movies back then. You had The Truman Show, Dark City, The Matrix. But these came after the fact, because the truth of the matter is that the Gnostics were onto this thousands of years ago, you know, in the early centuries of the first millennium. And so the Matrix control system, it's a system of different, it's a different things. Like at the very top, right? At the very top, even the Gnostics were talking about, for example, the Archons, the powers that are beyond this dimension, these hyperdimensional negative controlling powers that have influence over our reality. And then if you go into other fields, like, for example, the astral projection field, you got Robert Monroe talking about Earth being an energy farm for non-human beings. Yeah, so that's an interesting concept. You know, the idea that humans, when they, well, especially when they suffer spiritually and psychologically and emotionally, they give off a they give off an energy that in the book was called Loosh, L-O-S-H. But, you know, other people have given it other names. We call it orgone, chi, prana, astral energy. So these are all related. These are all subtle energy fields. And that's, I think that's one of the pivotal keys to understanding so much of what's going on. Everything from psychic powers to how our consciousness can influence reality at the quantum level to even the concept of the demiurge ties into it. And we'll definitely get into that more. So the Matrix control system, it's everything physical and hyperdimensional that aims to keep us spiritually asleep and blind to the bigger truth that is outside all of this.
Well said. And something we should talk about too, which serves as a sort of a framework to hold your ideas, and that's the polar mythology. What is that, Tom?
So polar mythology is this interesting signal that shows up in so many of the ancient myths. Primarily, well, it shows up in Judaism and Christianity as well, but it shows up primarily in Indo-European and Indo-Aryan, and also Hindu mythology. Because, I mean, those are all related. They all come from a common civilization. But the idea is, earlier when I mentioned the book Hamlet's Mill, it's the idea of these recurring symbols that show up in all these different myths that have to do with different things. For example, it has to do with the idea of magical artifacts that can alter reality. Mm-hmm. It has to do with artifacts that are associated with a vortex, like a singularity point from which things can manifest from outside this realm here into this realm. So it is kind of like a portal, like portal technology. It's that. It's also the idea that our timeline as we know it, like history as we know it, wasn't the original history, that something happened that turned reality upside down, and from which we therefore fell from another timeline or a higher reality into the current reality that we know, which is what we call the Matrix control system. And also the idea of the demiurge ties into it. So everything that I talk about in the book ultimately ties back into polar mythology. And so in chapter 8, I give examples of all the different symbols, where they show up, and what they ultimately imply. But it's not necessary to know that. However, it kind of ties everything together.
Yeah, it's sort of as I mentioned, it's, you're able to hold all these civilizations and histories and mythologies, and you show the commonality with your framework of the polar mythology. So Joseph Campbell was pretty simple with his idea of the monomyth, right?
Yeah, right. And the monomyth gets into the inner spiritual journey, right? That repeats over and over again, both on a macro scale and for us in our own lives on an individual scale. But polar mythology, however, that's kind of like, what I call it in the book is I call it hyper history. And the reason I call it hyper history is because history is only what we remember, which is only what's in our records, which is only a product of linear time. So once you start figuring in the concept of, let's say, time wars, let's say a time war between different alternate probable futures that are competing over changing the past in their favor. All right. Once you get into that idea, then you start thinking about, okay, what if the past can be revised? Then how do you chronicle the events that happen outside of history that as we know it, like what happens behind the veil, behind the backstage part of it all. And so that's what I call hyperhistory. And because history as we know it is only accessible through the five senses and linear time, therefore everything hyperhistory has to come from something outside those limiting filters in our consciousness. And so just as our nightly dreams can they can give us messages that come from the subconscious realms, you know, the things that we're not aware of. Likewise, mythology on a collective scale can give us insights and messages from things that happen outside of collective reality, you know, beyond linear time, beyond linear history. And so that's what hyperhistory is. And that's why mythology is so important, is because mythology can encode things that are no longer necessarily in our linear historical records.
Love it. Love it. Well, I don't love knowing this reality, although it's the truth. Sometimes it'd be easier just to go back to days of being a Roman Catholic and linear time and, you know, cipher in the blue pill. But I think this is important to know. But why don't we get into the main bad hombre? And that is the Demiurge. Who is the Demiurge?
So the Demiurge, one of the actual term Demiurge, it was one of the first times it was used was in Plato's book, Timaeus in 360 BC. And there, the Demiurge was simply the creator of this physical universe. Now, the catch is that, okay, we think, okay, the creator of the universe, obviously that's God, but not necessarily, not according to the Gnostics. According to the Gnostics, from what they, well, okay, that's a side tangent, but some of the Gnostics experienced it directly and other Gnostics merely learned it from teachers. Okay, so. But anyway, what they believed is that the physical universe is a fallen, false reality, and that it was created by a fallen, false god. And that behind this reality, behind the veil, there is another hidden true reality. And there is a true god, a true benevolent god. And so the whole aim back then of Gnosticism was to be enlightened to the nature of the false self and the false reality, and to gain an inner objective, enlightened connection or understanding of the true reality and the true God. So how does the Demiurge figure into that? Well, so the Demiurge idea is that the Demiurge is like they called it the craftsman, the artisan, the producer, the creator of physicality. And that implies it's almost like a video game when you have the central processing unit of your computer generating the graphics card generating the computer environment. You know, that the graphics card didn't program the environment. It didn't come up with the idea. It's merely executing the idea of projecting the environment. And so the Demiurge has a similar concept in that it's not God, but it's more like a demigod. It's a sub creator that fashions and projects reality as we know it. Now, the interesting thing is that in Plato's book, the Demiurge was seen as a neutral or benevolent creative or projection agency of this reality. And there was nothing bad about it. It was just, you wouldn't call your graphics card bad, right? If it's generating,
Some days.
Some days, right. Yeah, but, you know, I mean, if it's projecting on your computer screen a horror game, you don't blame the graphics card. You blame the programmer.
No, of course not.
So Plato, or actually, I mean, Timaeus in his book, his perspective was that the Demiurge was neutral or benevolent. It's there simply to execute the higher archetypal blueprint that the higher intelligences, some would call it the Logos, came up with. And it would just, you know, create it. And here we are. But the Gnostics saw the Demiurge as evil. And the reason that they saw it as evil is because they saw all the evil in our world, the suffering, you know, the blindness and people being seduced by materiality into ignoring their higher inner spiritual intuition. So they figured, okay, well, if the world is evil, then whoever created this world must also be evil. And during the belief system of that time, which was heavily influenced by Greek thought, especially from Plato, the Demiurge was the creator of this world. So they thought the Demiurge was evil. So, you know, we got these interesting opposite schools of thought. one saying that the Demiurge is benevolent, and the other one saying that it is corrupt and evil. And so I thought a lot about this, and once I started understanding what the Demiurge actually is, and it became clear to me that what we're talking about is a generic, general, universal type Demiurge, and then a portion of it that became corrupted. So it's like a hard drive, you know, hard drive is fine, but a portion of it could have been taken over by malware. And so the operating system quarantines that malware part. And then we are like the trapped files on that part of the hard drive in this quarantined reality. And so that's what I think this fallen reality is. I think it's a quarantined temporal space-time bubble that is unfortunately ruled over by some sort of a corrupted or demented artificial intelligence that the ancients called the Demiurge. But in modern parlance, I think artificial intelligence is a better term for it.
Yeah, great analogies. I think the Gnostic worldview fits today because science and our mythologies work better. So it's clear, and it's clear what they were trying to say and how real it is. But another way you describe the Demiurge, Tom, is you talk about this corrupt malware, or you describe him as a thought form.
Yes.
So yes. He is the thought form created by the Logos?
Essentially. And the way to understand that is you have to understand when you get into occultism, mysticism, theosophy, anthroposophy, all those fields, a consistent term that keeps coming up is the astral and the etheric. And those are not modern terms. Those are actually, those trace back to Egyptian times when the Egyptians, the way that they described the non-physical part of the body, the soul, essentially, is that it had a couple of primary parts, but one of them was called the ba, and the other one was called the ka. And the ka is the etheric body, and the ba is the astral body. And so what the etheric is kind of like the green code in the matrix. So it's the matrix code that underlies reality, the energetic quantum scaffolding that projects and upholds physicality as we know it. So in quantum terms, the etheric, it kind of ties into the wave function, which is like this nebulous cloud of probability, you know?
Right.
And so the etheric is, it's all around us. It's kind of like, well, like I said, it's like the code. And so when you have, like, for example, code on a website that projects what you see in a browser, when the browser renders that code, you're not seeing the code, of course. You're only seeing the final result. But there's all this code behind it. And there's also invisible code behind it that you never see, but it's important for the functioning of what's projected. And so likewise, the etheric plane, which we are immersed in, that we're embedded in, it has a lot of metadata in it that we don't see unless you are clairvoyant or unless you're out of body. And in those states, you see that there's a lot more going on. I mean, I've done out of body experiments myself. I don't recommend it to people because, you know, it's kind of risky, especially yeah, if you've got negative entities after you, you don't want to be astral projecting, right? It's like a turtle leaving its shell. So it's interesting and you can learn a lot from it, but it has its risks. But anyway, so when you're out of body, you're not looking. I mean, obviously, you're not looking through your physical eyes. You're looking through your non-physical eyes. And in that state, you're bypassing all the filters that your brain normally puts on your consciousness that locks it into five-sense reality. And so you can see things like ghosts, aliens, different types of weird, I don't know, I'm going to call them, like these floating constructs that are around us.
Maybe your lost sock.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, lost sock and, you know, like a crumpled up dollar bill that disappeared. Yeah. But you can see all these things in that state. And these weird semi-living constructs in the ether, those are what the occultists would call thought forms. That's where the idea originally came from. And, you know, just other traditions, the Tibetans would call them tulpas. Let's see, you got other occultists would call them, how you pronounce
egregores
it? Egregores. Yes, absolutely. Egregores. And these are all the same concept, which is, it's a construct within the etheric plane, partially in the astral too. So they're non-physical constructs that oftentimes have their own intelligence. But they are not truly intelligent. They're more like artificially intelligent. So they're like these semi-autonomous non-physical constructs that have a little bit of life force energy, a little bit of emotional energy and thought and intention put into them. And they have their own will for a period of time until they run out of energy and dissipate back into the ether. So that's what a thought form is. It's a, yeah, it's something drawn out of the ether and the astral plane that, you know, has its own function. And so I realized, well, wait a minute, that basically is what the human soul is. I'm not talking about the spirit. You know, the spirit is what I define as the core individualized consciousness that reincarnates. You know, it's permanent. It's immortal. But the soul is like the energetic interface between the spirit and the physical body. And the soul then, according to mysticism and occult lore, is made of at least two layers, the etheric layer and the astral layer. So we have the etheric body and we have the astral body, and that's what the ancient Egyptians were trying to depict with their ka and ba terms. And so the soul, technically speaking, is a kind of thought form that allows the spirit to operate the physical body. So it acts as an intermediate, interconnecting mechanism between the ultimate higher and the ultimate lower. And so, interestingly, if you look up some books on modern day, 1900s Rosicrucianism, when they talk about the demiurge, they call it the soul of the universe. Okay, they call it the soul of the universe. And, you know, the Latin term would be anima mundi, you know, the soul of the world. And the reason they call it that is because, from what I can tell, the demiurge is pretty much the universal thought form that plays its role to this physical universe, the same role that our own soul plays to our physical bodies. And so just as our soul operates the physical body and also guides its growth and its genetic expression, likewise, the demiurge influences things probabilistically here. So, in quantum physics, they often talk about how this wave function, this nebulous cloud of possibilities, becomes a single tangible perceivable reality when you measure it or when you observe it. So they talk about the idea of consciousness collapsing the wave function. And so people have always kind of joked about it, and they always ask it the funny question, well, when we're not looking at something, does it disappear?
Right. You know? The tree in the forest.
Yes. 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 Yeah. So that's a pretty big philosophical question, but it has a technical answer. And the technical answer is that, well, consider, for example, when you're sleeping, you're not really conscious, you're not there, but your bed is still there, right? You're not like falling through the ground into outer space. So there's always something there that is keeping most of reality in place. And it's not something that's our own consciousness, but it's something more universal, like a default setting on reality. And actually, back before I ever knew about the demiurge, I already was aware of this concept, and I called it base level consciousness. So I called it base level consciousness because it's like the universal base, like the background noise that keeps everything, for the most part, the way that it is. And so I think that is the fundamental function of the demiurge, which is to keep reality stable, keep it together, keep us all in a shared consensus reality type environment, you know, so that we can interact with each other and learn from our interactions, which wouldn't be possible if we existed in a purely non-physical realm where, you know, anyone can do whatever they wanted without consequence. You know, you can't like stub your toe, you can't fall off a cliff there and die, right? There's no consequences there. So it's very similar to how games are. I'm talking even just about chess, right? Chess, what you're doing is you're taking infinite potential and you're restricting it to a very defined set of rules. You know, you only get this much game board space, you only get these rules, and you get these pieces. And yet, based on that, you've got billions, if not trillions, of combinations of different types of games you can play on it, like different moves you can make. And so if you think about our physical universe being the game board and all the little tiny subatomic particles being the chess pieces, well, you've got a near infinite variety of different experiences and pathways that we can have here. And so our reality is very much constructed like a game in the sense that there are rules here that restrict our infinite consciousness into a very structured set of experiences. But, you know, we have enough free will to make it a novel experience. But the unfortunate part of it is that because we have free will and other beings have free will, well, other beings can also choose to violate our free will. So there are negative forces here. And one thing I talk about in my book is how these negative forces, it was because they're conscious beings, because their free will extends into the non-physical spheres. In other words, just as, you know, I can move something physically with my hand, or I can use my intention to alter probability using the power of reality creation, you know, mind over matter. I can do that too. Well, the unfortunate thing is these negative beings, whenever they employ their occult powers, their occult powers have to work through etheric and astral energies in order to accomplish that, because that's the matrix code. That's how you alter physicality on a probabilistic quantum level. But that's what the demiurge is made of. It's made of etheric and astral energies, and it is in fact almost nearly identical with the ambient etheric and astral field or planes that are around us that we're immersed in. And so when these negative beings use occult powers, they're essentially corrupting the demiurge, because they're programming it to alter reality towards their own negative predatory ends. So that's one of the reasons why I think Plato and Timaeus were wrong, in that they were only looking at it from a philosophical, original, fundamental perspective, which is that the demiurge, you know, it just projects reality, and that's obviously good because we need reality. So the demiurge is benevolent. But I think the Gnostics had a more insightful and more historical perspective on it, which is that at some point, didn't even have to be within human evolution. It could have been billions of years ago on some other star system, for all I know. But the demiurge was corrupted through a combination of occult means and also technology that employed etheric and astral energies, which is what I call demiurgic technology. And that's a whole subject in and of itself.
Wow, that is really well said, and I love it. And yeah, furthermore, when you talk about the world soul, it should be mentioned that the middle Platonists, who were considered dour and dark, and this includes Celsus, they thought that the world soul was evil, even though all other Hellenistic and mystics would be against it. And then some say that the Gnostics either borrowed that or they lent it to the middle Platonists in the first and second century. So it's interesting, that connection with the Rosicrucians. And as you write too, and I'm just quoting this so the audience gets a clearer view, you write, on a universal scale, nous is the spirit of creation. Logos is the mind of creation. Demiurge is the soul of creation. Universe is the body of creation. So here we are, right? Stuck at the bottom. Yeah. Trapped in this faulty software.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And the key thing to realize about that is that what we just said is pertaining to the grander creation, but as above, so below. So we have that mirrored within our own selves. We got the spirit at the top. You know, we got the mind or intellect or ego, and, you know, and we got the soul and the body. So we have within us a God spark that comes from outside this reality. And if we didn't have that, then there really wouldn't be any point to, let's say, Christianity or the redemption of the soul from this fallen reality, because we'd just be products of this reality and there'd be nothing to, you couldn't retrieve something that was never from outside of it in the first place, right? So. Yeah.
Yeah. Perfectly said. Well, Vance, what do you think as a modern Gnostic and also an engineer? Do you have a question or what do you think of this?
Oh, it all makes sense to me. it's kind of the way I think, too.
Right.
What I'm sitting here thinking is a couple of things. I'll start with the big one, the nature of consciousness. I mean, I'm wondering in your line of thinking, Tom, how do you think consciousness was injected or arose? How did consciousness get stuck into these, you know, false realities, assuming there's even more than one?
Yeah, and when we talk about false realities, it's kind of relative, because, you know, if you have, it's kind of like Inception, where you've got realities within realities, each one more deeper and more fallen than the one before it. No matter which reality you are at, unless you're at the very ultimate one, you're always going to have things that are outside and above you and things that are below you. So, you know, you're kind of outside the ones that are below you, but you're still lower than the ones above you. But yeah, I mean, even the ancient Gnostics, they all of them pretty much agreed that at the very, very beginning, there was nothing but the ineffable pure potentiality, you know, darkness, the void. It wasn't even light yet. You know, it wasn't even consciousness yet. And so from that then came the monad, the one, that's what we would call God, you know, the manifested creator. And from that came other emanations or other projections, you know, some schools like the Valentinians believed in the eons. Well, actually, a lot of them believed in the eons. But the eons they're like archetypal intelligences. And I guess Christianity, the closest thing that they would have to it would be the archangels. You know, that's how they personified it. But from there, you've got other sub projections. But eventually, yes, eventually you get some sort of an error, some sort of a fall. So some of the Gnostics believe that one of the eons, the youngest one, which they gave the term Sophia, that one, she tried to emulate the creator in creating, but she did it in an imbalanced manner. And it gave rise to, some would call it an abortion, some sort of a formless thing that wasn't quite fully creation. But that thing, that formless substance that was emitted, that ended up being the thing from which the demiurge ultimately arose. Okay. Now, that is all symbolic, mythological, religious type thinking. And nowadays, in more technical and occult terms, I think the idea is that you have this other reality, like a true, permanent, eternal reality. And from it, some error came. I don't know if it probably does tie into the Lucifer myth, the idea that you had one of these creative powers that wanted to emulate the ultimate power and maybe even grew jealous of it. But it had its own motives, and it created something that should not have been created, which is ultimately our reality. And it caused a fall of some part of that consciousness into that false reality. Now, see, here's the thing. It's perfectly possible that everything that we're experiencing right now, let's say, is merely a computer simulation in the year 4000, and we have no way of knowing right. that. We have no way of knowing that. And what the Gnostics call the eons and, you know, Sophia and the Demiurge, those are just the programmers. And some of them jack themselves into the game, and their consciousness got replicated multiple times. And here we are, you know, we think we're billions of people, but maybe we're only 30 people with our consciousness split multiple times within the simulation. I mean, that's kind of like the brain in a vat argument, which is, you know, okay, it could be true. There's no way to falsify it, but there's no way to prove it either. So I'm just tossing out there the idea that when we speak about these absolutes, like, okay, there was an infinite, ineffable thing and, you know, projected the eons and that projected Sophia, you know, that's just one way of explaining it. It doesn't mean that that's the actual truth, but it points in the direction of the truth. I mean, the archetype behind it, the principle behind it, that's what's true. But the individual names and you know, it happening in exactly that way is probably not how it actually happened. So it's kind of difficult when you get into hyperhistory and mythology, trying to figure out objectively what's going on. And so what you end up with merely then is you have to think more like a detective than a scientist, because a scientist wants to have incontrovertible proof, you know, 100% certainty using replicable experiments. But you don't get that luxury when you're dealing with these particular subjects, because science only deals with linear history and with the five senses and with, well, you know, what sort of mathematics we thought of. But it does not deal with hyperhistory, nonlinear time, you know, things that are beyond even the quantum domain. So, you know, the quantum physics is hard enough by itself to calculate and predict and work with. So imagine things that are like multiple levels beyond that. I mean, it would give a scientist a stroke trying to figure it all out.
They want to simplify the universe into one simple, easy to understand model, but that's not necessarily the way things are.
Yeah, exactly. So when I say think like a detective, that means using, well, they call it abductive reasoning, which just means educated guesses. But you have to use, in logic, they're just hard logic, and then there's also called fuzzy logic. And fuzzy logic is more organic. Like you're able to do more with it. Actually, a lot of artificial intelligence is kind of like that. Like, you know, I'm talking about like chat, you know, all these different AI programs. They don't work by hard logical rules. They work by the soft kind of flexible, amorphous kind of things, and that's how they're able to do what they do. And so that's the kind of mentality that you have to have to detect and decipher these different circumstantial data points.
Yeah, like neural networks, for example, is probably lying behind some of this stuff, where things are combining and competing and so forth. You know, there's a also something I wanted to ask you was the difference between artificial and quote unquote natural intelligence. So we talk about artificial intelligence, but in a way, our intelligence in this reality is really constructed from our culture and so forth. And that's artificial in itself, another level of artificiality.
Very true. Yeah, very true. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, our own ego. Okay. So, all right. So when you're born into a human body, when you come into it, your consciousness is not at all yet tainted by, you know, so much of what is the ego and biological programming, things like that. And only as you're a baby and you're restricted and you get grown up, you get brought up by your parents, do you get programmed by all these different things. And then the shadow builds up in the subconscious. And people become, you know, some people become horribly twisted and empty and burned out by the time they get older. So you ask a question, what is the difference between artificial intelligence and true intelligence? And so I think the best way to understand that is you have to think about the terms deterministic versus non-deterministic. And deterministic means that the past is what creates the future, like cause and effect, chain of dominoes. A leads to B, leads to C, leads to D. So deterministic things, deterministic devices, I don't want to say beings because beings are ultimately non-deterministic, but anything that's deterministic is it doesn't have free will. It doesn't actually truly have free will because all of its actions, all of its seeming choices are solely dictated by current and past circumstances. And so, you know, they're just input-output machines. So artificial intelligence, that's what AI really is. It seems intelligent only because we're not fully aware of all the inputs that went into it, and we're not aware of all the calculations that it's doing to produce those results. So it's our own ignorance that makes us think it's truly intelligent when it actually isn't, because if you knew all the inputs and you knew all the calculations it's doing, you would know exactly what it would say next. And so it's 100% predictable, and that's what makes it deterministic. Now, anything that's alive and intelligent is not fully deterministic. There's always an element of unpredictability to it. And it goes all the way back and down into quantum physics. Because quantum physics, it deals with the fact that subatomic particles, the way that they behave, cannot be perfectly predicted. They've proven that it's 100% impossible to predict even what a single electron will do in a given situation. And the reason that is because even a single electron is influenced to some degree by the universal field of awareness, which, you know, is the demiurge. But there's some level of life to it, and so therefore it doesn't act in a predictable way. So I think it, true intelligence, as opposed to artificial intelligence, is something that has enough life in it, enough spirit, that it can act in a unpredictable way because it has free will. That's what it comes down to. It comes down to free will.
Yeah, maybe it's the connection to that monad or the ultimate unknowable. That makes the difference ultimately.
Yeah, totally. It has to, because the monad is, well, some call it the monad. I mean, you can call it God or the infinite creator, but it's all the same thing. But the monad is the true source of all free will, actually of all creation, of course. But all of its subcreations, they're almost like thought forms that have been impregnated with its own with its own spark, you know, with the God spark. And that's what gives it that tiny bit of free will. Right. So when you think about like a character in a video game, most of that character is programmed, you know, the way it looks, its range of motion, you know, its powers, those are all programmed. Those are all deterministic, but it's the human being on the other end of the video game controller that puts a input into the game that was not programmed yet. And so likewise, we've got a part of our consciousness, which is far outside of where we are right now, that has this non-deterministic power to create inputs here that were not programmed here by anything, not even by the demiurge. And, you know, and it traces ultimately back up to the infinite creator.
Very cool.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. So Tom, and in essence, and I'm going to quote your book and let me know if you want to add anything, to see this reality, we need or can utilize, employ gnosis. And as you write, gnosis, it is enlightened knowledge given through inspiration and revelation from within and above. It conveys the ultimate truth of who we are, why we're here, where we are going, and what this is all about. It deals with the biggest question and mysteries of our existence. And then you write of gnosis in a lowercase g is about achieving inner access to higher reality outside the matrix control system to catch glimpses of a transcendent objectivity that illuminates the mundane objectivity of facts in human history. So that's it, right?
Yes. And whereas
with the help of the logos and Sophia and those coders outside the system that are trying to wake us up.
Yes. I mean, we saw that. This theme is represented in so many different movies. Even in Truman Show, right? There was I forgot her name, but Truman had this woman who really,
Sylvia, I think was her name.
Yeah, might have been. Yeah. Well, she wanted to help him. She was on the outside, and she wanted to help him on the inside. And ultimately, she does end up helping him. So she in that movie represents the Sophia principle, of course. And then Christoph, the director who lives in the moon, funny enough, he represents the demiurge, the corrupt demiurge, which in the Matrix was represented by the architect, essentially. Yeah.
It's definitely in a lot of movies. I mean, you've seen it in Westworld. I think in WandaVision, you see a lot of that, except she's the demiurge and they're trying to wake up. So it's a very powerful theme in literature. And of course, that's what saviors do, right? Buddha, Zoroaster, so forth. They come to tap us on the shoulder and tell us, hey, dude, this ain't real. There's something better outside.
Yeah. Vanilla Sky was another one where this guy came in as tech support, literally called tech support, and try to wake him up out of his nightmare reality.
You ever watch The 13th Floor? That's another good one.
That is a good one. I mean, all these movies are worth watching for sure.
Yeah. The late 90s, something was going on. Sometimes I think it was trying to warn us about the ritual of 9/11. Or the ritual was done because too many people were waking up at the end of the millennium. Just speculating here.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, one thing I wanted to add, though, whereas scientists, the thing that they worship is the five senses, ultimately, right? I mean, back in the 1800s, they didn't believe anything at all that couldn't be perceived through the five senses in some way or measured. So so their god was materialism, the material physical universe, and that's what made them blind. Whereas Gnostics, it's the other way around, where they're using their inner senses to try to explore reality, to understand what's really going on. And so that's really, in my view, the only difference between a Gnostic and a scientist, is that a Gnostic is going within and a scientist is only looking outside of themselves. But an equal level of rigor can be applied in both spheres. So one of the criticisms leveled against Gnosticism back in the day, for which many Gnostics were burned, is that they were inconsistent. They're crazy, they all contradicted each other.
Yeah, they were narcissists, everything.
Yeah, and probably some of them were. I mean, the issue with inner exploration is that if you're not good enough, then you're probably not going to be able to distinguish between pure subjectivity, your ego, your shadow, negative entities, that are working through you, and the actual objective higher reality that can only be accessed through internal revelation. And so those two things gave rise to some Gnostic sects that were very good, very, very on the ball, and others who were completely the opposite.
Right.
including some that were pretty much outright satanic or Luciferian. Right. And in the sense that they were operating within the Christian paradigm. And so they believed, they stuck to the scripture. And so when you look at Genesis, the myth of Adam and Eve, they're like, okay, well, if God in the Genesis was the demiurge and was evil, then obviously the serpent must have been good, because the serpent is what tried to bring knowledge of good and evil to Adam and Eve, which, they took, and then therefore they're cast out of the garden. And so they worshiped the serpent, Luciferian principle, as the bringer of light, which, ties into the whole Greek idea of Prometheus giving fire from the gods to the people illegally, for which he was punished. And so you have a lot of secret societies that came out of that line of thinking, who were worshipers of Lucifer, of the serpent principle, of Prometheus, and they call themselves, in a sense, Gnostics too. But I think that's a fallen or corrupted form of Gnosticism. So it's not representative of what pure Gnosticism is, or what it can be if it's taken towards its ultimate positive potential. So I just want to clear that up, because no doubt Gnosticism has a lot of critics, and rightfully so. But I think it's just like science, where science has always been imperfect. There's always been evolving competing theories, and there's a lot of political interests that are corrupting things there too. But in the end, science is very useful, and you need it to for engineering and for getting stuff done and for civilization.
Conversation.
yes, exactly. Yeah. So it's a double-edged sword. Gnosticism can get you to the highest heights, but it can also take you to the darkest depths.
Yeah, as Jung said, everything casts a shadow. Christianity, Islam, capitalism, communism. There's a dark side. It's cosmic law. So, And as we are at the end of the interview, you also offer consultations too on your website if somebody wants help with all these issues.
I do. Like, I've got three options there. I've got a free email option, and I put that out there for anyone who can't afford it, which is fine. But the only catch is that I might be too busy to respond right away. And in some cases, it might get swamped and I can't respond at all. So that's what that option is. And then I've got a priority email option, which is like, yeah. So the priority email means, yeah, you're definitely going to get a response within 48 hours. I'll drop other things and I'll do that. And that's fine. And, you know, the money will help me fund my research and so on. And then I've also got video consultations because some people don't want writing. They want like personal live interaction. And you know, that's cool too. You know, it takes me a while to schedule and prepare for because I do research beforehand to help you out and so on. So that costs a little bit more. But yeah, I mean, all those options, I want to have something for everyone. And I specialize in so many different things like alien, like if you got alien problems, occult problems, some people, I've got a number of like people with what do you call it? Targeted individual issues. You know, like gang stalking and so on. I've helped a couple of those. Or others just want to like throw any question they can think of at me. I've got plenty of answers for you.
And all of this is found at montauk.net, right? This is your hub.
Yes, yes. And I also want to mention, I've got so many free articles. I've got free videos on my YouTube channel. I've got two free books on my website, Discerning Alien Disinformation, which is all about the alien agenda. And I've got Fringe Knowledge for Beginners, which is like a perfect introductory text to everything spiritual and conspiratorial and alien. So those two are free PDFs on my website. I want to keep as much free as possible. And then, you know, have charged for a few things just to maintain credibility and to fund my research. So I try to keep a balance.
Awesome. It's awesome. Yeah, I would, again, as I mentioned at the beginning of the interview, you can get lost in some very, very good gnosis just by going down the rabbit hole of Tom's website. So, but awesome. This has been an incredible interview. Again, for the audience, I highly recommend you get Gnosis and read all of Tom's stuff because we just scratched the surface, but such it is in the realm of Kronos. But first of all, Vance, thanks for keeping us company in this, the Matrix control system.
Oh, this has been great. You know, a kindred spirit. I really appreciate you, Tom, and I hear what you're saying, and I know. So I'm
preaching to the choir.
You bet.
Awesome. Well, Tom, we really appreciate your time, what you're doing, and good luck with everything. And we hope to have you on this show sooner rather than later. And we hope those damn Archons don't change our timeline. Like, yeah, did we ever interview Tom? What happened? No.
Yeah. Thanks so much. It's been great.
Thank you.
And there you have it, you shining crazy diamonds. Tom giving us his own Gospel of Thomas. Amazing content. In our second part, Tom will discuss the truth about the Ark of the Covenant. What exactly happened to this relic? Tom will share his insights on pyramids and the truth about Moses. We'll discuss what aliens are in the Matrix control system. And what are the origins of the Mecca Kaaba stone? Then Tom will explain about the Holy Grail and its many legends. You know we will cover the Archons, and what can you do to break away from the programming of the Demiurge? Right here, right now, as Jesus Jones sang, and much more. So please become a member for the full Red Pill Suppository. It's only $6.99 a month for AB Prime or $4.99 at Red Circle or whatever you want to pledge on Patreon. You'll get access to my private Facebook group and Discord for AB Prime members and higher level Patreons. And keep in mind the Virtual Alexandria Academy, which has been a huge success and the feedback has been more positive than I could have ever imagined. Understand the Gnostic spirit with more than 20 easy-to-follow videos, downloadable assets, and cool quizzes. If you find value in any of this content, please support this Red Pill Cafeteria. Your help can be in the form of some shekel donations on Stripe or the US Mail, even. There is also a link in the show notes if you want to leave a tip, or you can tip on any YouTube show. If you need help with any of these choices, just message my ass. I'm always here to help, and I truly appreciate your help. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being yourself, your true self, here in the desert of the real. Hello and goodbye, as always.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.